On the 5th of March 2014, Dharmavidya visited Amida Malvan, and after our regular evening service, did a question and answer session. This is the recording of that session.
Well, I'm here and I'm open to interrogation. Is what word that came to mind after your introduction. I've spent the whole day. This morning I was at, giving a lecture to undergraduates who sort of were in the mode of just trying to soak it all up, and then in the afternoon I was leading a seminar, facilitating a seminar with more adult students who mostly professional people, therapists and so on. So that was much more a discussion and questioning, exploration. But we could take this wherever you want to go, really.
Dharmavidya, I have a question. It's about faith and fear.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a preamble to this.
Most people are quite frightened of faith. That's true.
Okay, faith versus fear. Okay, there is a preamble to this, which is short, but is necessary.
Mm.
There's a pilgrimage through Spain, the Camino de Santiago.
Yes, I...
Which was walked mostly in medieval times. So over time, there have been tens of millions of pilgrims who have walked
to Santiago. It's very popular at the moment. I see hundreds of them. Because I spend quite a lot of time in that bit of the country.
Oh, okay.
And I'm often driving along roads that are part of the Camino.
Okay.
And many, many pilgrims.
Yeah, I think, you know, over the last 10 years, so it's just...
Yeah.
It's
well, it was kind of, in a way, repopularized, I think, quite substantially by Paulo Coelho's book, which sort of brought it back to people's attention. But yes, go on, distracting.
So, in the medieval times, you know, for people who don't know, most people, pilgrims, the people would walk for various reasons, but most often would be to receive indulgences, which would be sort of years off, struck off your time in purgatory before you entered the kingdom of Christian heaven.
Yes.
Or you would be pardoned for all your sins once you reach Santiago, and therefore go straight into heaven. So as I'm on there, the longer I'm there, the more what I see is become attuned to my surroundings. Part of which is sensing the presence of what could be described as lost souls or wandering spirits or hungry spirits. And often these would collect at a place of prayer, because in conversations with other people, with my sort of maybe intuition or maybe imagination, we sort of came to the conclusion that these wandering spirits were people who died on the Camino. The Camino's littered with hospices. Pilgrims were dying like flies.
Yeah.
You know, you'd walk to Santiago, and then you'd walk back at that time. So feeling the presence of these sort of tormented souls who would die, feeling that they were in a place where at the point of death they would now enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah.
And evidently weren't, because they were still wandering up and down the Camino looking for some kind of solace or escape. Or I'm at the time thinking, what must that be like? That must be, you know, truly horrible, horrible experience to have that amount of faith and then find out that what you expected when you died AG to enter the kingdom of heaven didn't happen, and instead you were wandering around like hungry spirits, not knowing what's happened to you. So these are things that I've sort of thought about quite a lot. And speaking as a Pure Land Buddhist, the thought comes to my mind sometimes that with precepts, the Nimbutsu calling out in faith to Amida, and putting your trust in faith and in Amida. As I understand it, that at the point of death, by calling out to the Amida in complete faith, then you will enter the Pure Lands at the end of this life. Not at the end of future life, but at the end of this life. And I can't help but wonder, well, what if that doesn't happen? What if the same thing happens as what happened to the Christians on the Camino in the medieval times? And I find that is quite a block to my faith or to... And just one more thing that occurs to me is that when I heard the Nimbutsu for the first time, I thought, there's something that resonates with me. And then two and two maybe making an answer other than four, it sort of occurred to me that, well, it's because I recognise it from a previous life.
Possible.
And if I was a devotee in a previous life, then what am I still doing wondering about in San
And the answer is?
Just an easy one to start you off.
It has become more and more important. Other than not having the depth of faith, which I think I have, being the answer, I can't drum up any other answer than that, not being as faithful as a capacity builder I am.
Well, I suppose this is true for all of us, that we don't have as much faith as we sometimes think we have or think we should have or whatever. I suppose if you had complete faith, then it wouldn't actually matter to you what happened when you died. So, because you would leave it in the hands of. You wouldn't want to be if one is using the Nembutsu or any other practice, Christian prayer or whatever, as a means of manipulating God, Amida or whoever to do what you want them to do, this in a way shows a lack of faith in a kind of advanced sense, if you see what I mean, because we're kind of trying to get control of the universe, which of course we all are. The ego is sort of one way or another, by whatever metaphysic it clings onto or whatever theory it has, but it's sort of grasping nature is to try and control in this way. And thinking in terms of spirits and lost spirits and so on, it certainly has been a very important way for human beings to understand what happens at that point. And what it brought to my mind is what's happening in northern Japan at the moment, because there are, with the Fukushima tsunami disaster, huge numbers of people were killed, and often whole families. Now, the Japanese have quite an element of Confucianism and so on in their culture, and the feeling is that those spirits who've died depend to some degree on the devotion of their relatives. But in many cases there aren't any relatives, because the whole lot were wiped out at one go. The whole village was just washed out to sea and sunk. So there's nobody left. So I was reading an account just a week or so ago of about a Zen priest in northern Japan who's finding a large part of what he's doing at the moment is kind of exorcisms, where he's bringing these spirits into the temple, into a place of light, into a place of love, to put them at peace. So the notion there is that there's a sort of relationship between the living and the dead. Now, you're quite right that in sort of classic Pure Land Buddhist thought, it should be sufficient that when you die, you turn your mind to Amida in faith, and you wouldn't need your relatives or anything. But, as you say, I mean, none of us probably have that complete faith. And faith is a sort of... it's the other side of ego. You know, letting go of the ego is having faith. And none of us have actually let go of our egos completely. And even when we do manage to let go of them, they tend to come back. You know, they're very, very persistent, very tenacious. But you're quite right. I mean, if you imagine being a lost soul, it would be a horrible experience, I guess. But some of us are lost souls without having died. Yeah. And again, the same is true. We depend on one another. We need help from one another. We need a sense of acceptance. We need to be accepted. You know, one of the sort of hallmarks of Pure Land Buddhism is that being accepted as we are. It's not a matter of accomplishing something and then. There's a kind of profound psychological, spiritual impact when one actually feels accepted as one is. Because one probably doesn't accept oneself as one is. You know, we might talk about it, it's a very popular idea in popular psychology, accept yourself as you are, da, 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 da. But we don't, you know, none of us does, not profoundly. So the sense that there might be, or that there is, an acceptance of that kind is deeply touching, disarming, takes away our defensiveness. And this really, it's this kind of diminishment of the self, which is liberating. We were talking, if I go off a slight tangent, I was talking about, in another context, talking about willpower and so on. And we were talking about, as an example, the difficulty that people have in giving up something like smoking or, you know, and I know of somebody who gave up smoking when they'd had one lung removed. Mm. And of course you would say, well, they really should have given up sooner. But the interesting thing from a spiritual point of view is really the trying to penetrate into why can they now when they couldn't before? You see, because in terms of the sort of popular psychological ideas, you'd say, well, perhaps now they've got more willpower, but that seems rather unlikely that a person who's now kind of handicapped and defeated has got more willpower than they had when they were hale hearty and believed in themselves, you see. I mean, what's actually happened is that they've been diminished, not that they've been inflated in some way. And probably you could say that the earlier phase, when they were smoking and couldn't give it up, even though they might pay lip service to, yes, I know this is bad for you and I should, and so on, but they didn't. It's because really, deep down, they believe, well, I'm a special case, you know, cancer only happens to other people, it's not going to happen to me. I can handle it, you know. Same with alcohol, you know. I'm not an alcoholic, I can handle six bottles of vodka, you know, nobody else can, but I can. It's that sort of arrogance, really, that makes it impossible for the person, or very difficult for the person to stop. But when that broken by some traumatic experience, the person has to they realise that it becomes real for them, yes, that they're not actually a special case, that there's all sorts of forces at work, physical forces, medical forces, spiritual forces, whatever, that are more powerful than us individually. And when you realise the reality of your situation, then the whole equation changes. You know, probably the person I'm referring to, actually, it becomes easy for them to give it up, because they now see it as an enemy. You know, they now see it as something that's out to kill them. And this is quite different from feeling I can handle it. Who knows? And so it's kind of in the core philosophy of Buddhism that traumatic experiences, dukkha, setbacks, problems, defeats, are situations where things can go either way. These can be the things that destroy you, but they can also be the gates through which salvation opens up. And this will be the same for your spirits, you see. So the priest in North Japan who's welcoming these spirits into his temple and chanting the Heart Sutra with them, the framework's the same, you know, in that they feel loved, they feel accepted as they are, even as wandering, hungry ghosts. And sometimes we're all wandering, hungry ghosts at one time or another. You know, we all have our spells as hell beings or whatever. And it's actually at those times that we need acceptance. You see, as we are. And of course, as a sangha, you know, we create an ambience, a good feeling amongst ourselves, and we help one another. But even here, you know, we're still weak human beings. And we have our limits and so on. I don't know that I've answered your question, but it was a good springboard. Saying some things that might be helpful one way or another. A good bit of my life is spent now either in France or in northern Spain. And, Okay, let's have another.
Well, it sort of carries on a little bit from that, really, because of what you were and Brian were saying about sort of needing to sort of have that faith, you know, when you die and then you can move to the Pure Land. So that would obviously require a degree of consciousness and a degree of clarity and ability to do that. So I'm thinking, for example, people with dementia or people who've had strokes or whatever. What would be the scenario for them, regardless of whatever faith they've got, if they actually can't do that at the end?
Yes. Well, the this problem came up quite. This question was asked quite a lot in Japan in the time when Pure Land was becoming popular, because prior to Honen and Shinran, there was that feeling that it kind of came out of a traditional idea that the crucial thing was the state of mind you were in at the point when you died. And a classic story is the one of the samurai comes to see Honen, and he says, "Look, I'm just about to go into battle, and probably I'll get killed in this battle because the odds are a bit against us. But knowing myself, at the point where I'm killed, I'm not going to be thinking about the Nembutsu. I'm probably going to be thinking hateful thoughts about the person who's sticking his sword through them. And I'm a soldier, I'm a brave man. I think I can cope with somebody sticking a sword through me, but I don't like the idea of what's going to happen to me afterwards." And Honen, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it's along the lines of, he could see that this man has faith because he wouldn't have come and asked the question if he didn't. And for sure he might lose it in that moment, but we all lose it in moments. You see? The moment of the end of death is not really any different from any of the other moments in our life. But faith is something that pervades. You see, this is related to the business about mindfulness. Mindfulness is, there's a great vogue for mindfulness at the moment. And mindfulness is being interpreted as meaning being sort of ultra conscious or fully aware. And not what mindfulness meant originally, you see. Mindfulness or heartfulness might be better. Mindfulness is about what you've got in your heart. You see? What your heart is full of. Mindfulness, heartfulness. So it's what's in there. Now, if you've got something really in there, you know, maybe you love somebody. Okay? You've got love in your heart for that person. That love doesn't disappear when you go to sleep. It doesn't disappear when you're not thinking about them, you're doing your job. Yeah? It's there all the time. It's there whether you're conscious of it or not conscious of it. You see? What you have in your heart endures. The point about mindfulness is not something that's just of this moment, so long as you keep your attention on it, because you can't do that. Attention wanders. Yeah? But you don't stop loving somebody because your attention's wandered. Yeah? It endures. Yeah? So what matters are the things that endure. And in a way, your faith, Shin, is simply the most authentic bit of you. That's all. And of course, you've got lots of other bits that will sort of wander in and out. You know, this thing. You know, this symbol. Like we've got lots of clouds wandering across our sunshine, you see. And that's how it is. But that doesn't mean the sun's gone. It doesn't mean the sun's no longer there. You know, if you have faith in your heart, if you have love in your heart, if you have generosity in your heart, it's there. It's there when you're aware of it, and it's there when you're not aware of it. Dogen, great Zen master, in Genjo Koan, which is like one of his key texts, he says, even with enlightenment, somebody may know they're enlightened, or they might not know they're enlightened, but still be enlightened. Because the issue is not about self-consciousness. It's about a quality that you have deep inside you. You know, and so you take something, take a simple quality, like, say, generosity. You might be aware of being a generous person, but there's plenty of people who are generous who are not particularly aware that they themselves are a generous person. That's just how they are. You see what I mean? You know, so consciousness, and especially self-consciousness, may be there, it might not, but it doesn't matter, really. It's not the point. That's not what it's about. What it's about is what's the authentic quality in the person. So some of your Buddhist practices are about exploring those qualities, and that might be useful, but it might not. You know, I mean, if the person who's naturally generous explores themselves and one day realizes, oh, actually, I'm quite a generous person. I mean, it might strike, if they're really authentic, it might just strike them as sort of surprising, you know. Yes, I suppose I am, really. But so what? You know, I mean, there's even a danger there that it might corrupt their generosity. You know, the self-awareness might actually be a nuisance rather than a help. I think you can see how that can happen. Self-consciousness, sometimes useful, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's an obstacle. You know, if you're dancing and you suddenly become self-conscious, you probably miss a step. You know, it's not necessarily a help. So there is a sort of, in our culture, there's a sort of worship of consciousness. And consciousness obviously is useful. But it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the aim of what Buddhism's about. It's not an exercise in how can I be more and more and more conscious. The Buddha said, famously, I am one who sleeps well. So Buddha means somebody who's awake, and the Buddha says, I'm one who sleeps well. But these are not actually contradictory. No, the Buddha means, quite literally, he does sleep well. He gets his 8 hours or whatever. Why? How? Well, because he has good things in his heart. You know, he's not worried and anxious and fighting himself and da-da-da-da. Because there's good stuff in his heart. And that good stuff's there, whether he's conscious of it or not conscious of it. Sometimes he is, sometimes he's not. What was the question? Yes.
Yes, so I've got a question that just leads on from what you just said. About how to get those good things in our hearts.
How to get the good things in our
heart. And I suppose, you know, is that just a matter of grace?
I think it is, but, you know, what can one say that's useful or practical? I mean, gratitude is quite a useful thought. if we look at our life and we appreciate what we've got and what we receive, it sort of establishes a good root.
Yeah.
Many good things come from gratitude. It tends towards a greater acceptance. It tends towards generosity. It tends towards dissolving anxieties and so on. So in Pure Land Buddhism, there's been quite an emphasis on gratitude. So that you have things like Nikan retreats, where you think, what have I received? You know, which is a very practical sort of application of basic Buddhist idea of dependent origination. Our lives depend. You know, we depend on conditions, all sorts of conditions. Especially chocolate cake is an absolute essential of life. But we have a regular supply. And but yes, I mean, we depend on things. And anything you can look at in more than one way, can't you? I mean, you can then get anxious about it and you say, oh dear, you know, I'm dependent on things. Then I worry about whether I'm going to get them or not. You know? But equally, you can look at it the other way. You're grateful. You know? It's amazing what I've received. And so I think practices of that kind that make us appreciative certainly contribute to what you're saying. How do you get good things in your heart? You know, I mean, popularly, it's quite popular to say things like it all comes from within, but it doesn't. You know, I mean, we live in a world. We live amongst conditions. We receive, and actually, we're receiving all the time. We're sitting in this warm room at the moment. We're the recipients of thousands of years of civilization, really, that creates conditions that, at a very sort of practical social levels, as citizens of Europe, for all that we're in a bit of sort of economic downturn or crisis, we are some of the most fortunate human beings who've ever walked the earth. You know, you look at things like infant mortality rates, longevity, amount of violence in society, all sorts of very basic social indicators. We're some of the most fortunate people who've ever been. And we have a tendency just to take it all for granted. You know, but it's not. I mean, and when you've travelled quite a bit, like I have, I mean, you see lots of places that are an awful lot worse. you think, my goodness, I wouldn't want to. You know, so I think yes, developing gratitude puts good things in your heart. It's also. In relationships, you know, that there's a sort of give and take between people, and developing a depth of appreciation, very important. And gratitude for our spiritual practice. You know, I mean, we end of our meetings, we bow to the Buddha, representing like 85 generations of teachers who've given us this practice, which it's a big thank you. Mm-hmm. And we say thank you to each other. So I think gratitude is very important. I asked a Japanese priest, what was the difference between Jodo-shu and Shin-shu, two different forms of Pure Land in Japan. He said, oh, well, When Jodo Shu say Namo Amida Buddha, they're saying please, and when Shin Shu say Namo Amida Buddha, they're saying thank you. So my recommendation to you is that when you say Namo Amida Buddha, you're saying please and thank you. Because my mummy always said you should always say please and thank you.
Mentioned about a samurai. Would it be acceptable now for a Pure Land Buddhist to be in the army?
Well, you know, acceptable to who? You know, people are in the army. And everything that humans do has its strengths and its weaknesses. You know. From a classic point, Pure Land became popular, I suppose, because it did accept everybody. The whole notion of Amida accepting everybody, all acceptance, is kind of key. You know? And in Japan, which was at that time a caste society, quite rigidly so that you had no choice about what you did, whether you were a soldier or not, or a fisherman or not, or even a prostitute, was probably determined by your position in society. You didn't have a choice about it. I mean, we make career choices and we go to college and we get bits of paper and da 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 da. Wasn't like that. You're born in that village to that family, so you are, and that's what you'll be. And of course, in the sort of terms you're talking, this, if you're a fisherman, spend your whole life killing sentient beings, where did you stand with Buddhism? You know, it was a deep spiritual dilemma. Each person is making their spiritual experiment with life. And it takes each of us wherever it takes us. One might be a conscientious objector, another might be a soldier. You try and understand the spirit of the particular person as deeply as you can. I mean, personally, I would say it'd be much better if we had a world without any soldiers. But on the other hand, you can think of situations and positions where I might think it'd be better to have a world without soldiers, but I am rather glad that some soldiers went into Rwanda at a certain point and stopped all the killing. It's that kind of world we're in. Many of the things that you face are kind of invidious. It's easy to think about situations where conventionally good actions have good outcomes, and it's easy to understand situations where conventionally bad actions have bad outcomes, but there's plenty of the other two options. Mm-hmm. You know, there's plenty of situations where doing some harm has prevented some greater harm, or where doing something that was conventionally good has had disastrous consequences. So life's not simple, not straightforward. And when you try and understand an individual deeply, they've always, in some way or other, done the best they could with what they've got by their best lights. You know, I think it's like, do the best you can with the wisdom you've got, and then probably more will be given to you. But there can be a certain nobility in being a soldier. And soldier probably sees himself as protecting the lives of others. So he's experimenting with that. He's finding out. And of course, everybody's life is shaped by conditions. Coming to my mind, some years ago, I knew Jimmy and Sarah Boyle. Jimmy Boyle was a murderer, and in Scotland, in Glasgow. And he killed somebody and was locked up in Ballinnie prison. And Sarah was the psychiatrist in that prison. And she fell in love with him. And they got married while Jimmy was still in prison. Which, of course, professionally unacceptable. So she lost her profession. That's love, isn't it? I mean, my goodness, she gave up her being a psychiatrist, privileged, well-paid, position, because of her love for Jimmy. And Jimmy had been brought up in Glasgow gangland. I mean, when I was a social worker, I can remember a young lad who came onto my caseload because committing some crimes, and you think, oh, bad boy, see these things he's done. Then you find out about his family. Well, I mean, his father was a thief, his mother was a thief. He's just been a good boy, following the family tradition. What do you expect? And Jimmy was a bit like that, that was the culture he'd grown up in. And but of course, when Jimmy did come out, he did his 10 years in jail. And then, he's married to Sarah and they set up house and they started quite a lot of charitable projects in Glasgow. And of course Jimmy was very well placed to understand what it was like for young lads in Glasgow, who'd been one, and that sort of turn is very kind of characteristic of Buddhism. You look at the great teachers; they've usually had some sort of difficult history of some kind, which they've managed to turn around. It's out of the dukkha that the liberation comes. It's not just a sort of stepwise progression of getting gooder and gooder and gooder and eventually the best. It's rather hitting a wall and that wakes you up. And Jimmy went on experimenting with life. He became quite a sculptor, actually. Produced quite a lot of good artwork and stuff. It's very difficult to judge another person. Is it acceptable? Acceptable to who? What does it mean? To Amida, yes, it's all acceptable. Mm-hmm. It's human. Everybody's doing the best they can in their way. By the light they've got. Some people have just got a little candle, you can't see very far. But if you do what you can, in where you can see, actually more light will be given to you.
We could either stop there or have one more.
Just a quick one then.
I was was running a workshop in Spain. The last workshop I was running in Spain, I said to the group on the Sunday, I said, because they like having a siesta after lunch, so you have a sort of long lunch break usually, you see, and I said, do you want to come back at 1:30 and finish at 3:30, or would you like to come back at 2 and finish at 4? They said, we want to come back at 1:30 and finish at 4. Well, there is another one, we could take it.
Dharma Vidya, the latest little trick I've found that I'm playing on myself is that, especially, you know, relating to what you were saying about Jimmy Boyle and the dukkha and, you know, dukkha leading to the path, starting on this thing a few years ago now, it felt very linear. Felt like it was all, the language was all, I'm on a spiritual path, I'm on a journey, this is going somewhere. Mm. Playing very much into my Western idea that if I try hard enough to do something, I'm going to bloody get somewhere.
Yeah.
It's going to be...
Yeah.
Doing it.
Yeah.
Since taking refuge and becoming...
Sort of,
you know,
I'll be good and then you owe me.
Very much playing into that. Immediacy seems to completely, you know, just turn that on its head.
Yeah.
Feels like it.
Yeah.
It feels, I don't have any intellectual process with it, but it feels like it turns it on its head.
Yeah.
You know, we're accepted as we are. We don't
yeah.
have to go anywhere. We don't have to be anything else other than we are. And that's been the case for a while. It's very relieving. But the trick feels that actually, if I look at things genuinely, I'd say, well, no, actually, I am more skillful. I am being, you know, I am spreading more peace and joy. I'm bumping into less people. My actions are more honourable. So there is an accumulation of gooder things happening, which seems, again, another twist on that. Oh, I am going somewhere then.
Mm.
Do you see what I was saying?
Well, you might be, you see, but you're not.
No, I don't think I am. I was saying
you might be, but you're not in control of it, you see. I mean, it's like in a relationship, you know, if you're in a good relationship and you have this other person who loves you, you find that you behave better. You see? So it's just a natural process. Because you care about them and you feel cared about yourself. So quite naturally, you behave better. And that's not really that you're then on a path, it's just something that happens. Because Buddhism isn't really a path. Buddhism's more like opening a gate into a big field. You know, and actually the big field, you know, you go through this gate and there's sort of a fence here and a fence here and there's the field in front of you, but there's no fences on the other side. It's just it just gets more and more because it's actually about liberation, you see. And when we really feel we have the freedom, when we feel we're trusted, we're actually more likely to behave in what people generally call a decent way. It just happens naturally. Because a lot of our bad behaviour is to do with the way we're fighting ourselves, or we're fighting somebody else, or we're frightened, or and all those sorts of processes, the energy is taken out of them when you feel more accepted, loved, free. You don't need to anymore. Yeah.
It's
get to keep anything.
Well, you know, you can keep things, and the more things you keep, the more trouble there'll be to you. And,
even the chocolate cake.
You don't keep it, do you? It goes. Not much left, I must say. Yeah. No, live lightly. Not in kind of, it shouldn't be in a sort of rigid way, like you conform to some communistic formula. But live lightly. You know, you've got possessions, use them for good things and appreciate them, but don't hang on to them too tightly.
Mm.
Well, they just become a burden, really. Namo Amitabha. The original and sacred vows are the unique and essential path to enter the pure land. Therefore, with body, speech, and mind, we are devoted to the teachings that all may attain the state of bliss.
Namo Amitabha.